Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inform, a division of the Commonwealth Club and for people in their 20s and 30s. With a mission to inspire debate around civic issues, I'm Barbara Rogers, anchor of CBS 5 Eyewitness News. I have visited the African continent many times, and each time I've marveled at its beauty and uniqueness and enjoyed the warmth and hospitality of its people. But I've also had so many questions about what it will take to solve the problems of countries there. In 2005, 2 billion people around the world viewed the Live 8 concerts organized by famous rock musicians Bono and Bob Geldof, who passionately appealed for Western leaders to do more to end poverty in Africa. A week later, the leaders of the 8 leading industrial nations pledged to double aid to Africa and to forgive the debts of 14 of Africa's poorest countries. President George W. Bush joined in this dramatic moment, outlining how the U.S. would double its aid to Africa, taking a hard look at the numerous issues facing Africa from HIV/AIDS to hunger and civil war. It is essential to distribute aid effectively. Equally important is evaluating the strategic political importance of Africa to the United States. How should foreign assistance toward Africa be prioritized? Tonight, our expert panel will attempt to answer these questions and others. They are Princeton Lyman, a senior fellow and director for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served for over 3 decades at the U.S. Department of State and the U.S. Agency for International Development as ambassador to South Africa, ambassador to Nigeria, and director of refugee programs. Dr. Tete Kofi is a professor of economics at the University of San Francisco. He has published numerous articles, including the Africa Report for Business Week, and developed reports for the World Bank, United Nations organizations, and the government of Ghana. And J. Stephen Morrison is the director of the Africa Program and the Task Force on HIV/AIDS at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Dr. Morrison co-chaired the reassessment of the U.S. approach to Sudan that led the basis for the Bush administration's push for a negotiated peace settlement and led the State Department's initiative on illicit diamonds. Please welcome our panel. We're going to start tonight, since we just talked about Live 8 and the actions of the G8 that came afterwards. Let's start by each of our panelists giving their opinion on what effect those actions have had on Africa and its problems. Was Live 8 and the subsequent actions of the G8, were those actions beneficial? We'll start with you, Mr. Lyman.
Thank you. I think the actions did a lot to mobilize popular opinion and to put pressure on governments to address many of the issues in Africa, and it led to major new commitments of foreign aid and debt relief. But two things were missing in that set of events. One is, if you looked at the Live 8 concert, no Africans appeared on the stage. There was no sense of what Africans were doing, who was taking charge of these issues in Africa, and that left an impression that Africa was simply an object of charity rather than a partner. The second thing is that it didn't demonstrate, particularly for the United States, that we had a broad set of interests and a growing set of interests in Africa that went beyond just the humanitarian, as important as that was.
All right. Thank you. And Mr. Morrison.
The G8, you know, the club of the world's wealthiest countries, has taken up Africa increasingly in recent years. And this Live 8 concert was tied in the lead up to the G8 summit in Glen Eagles. There were major debt relief commitments made there that directly benefited 14 African countries. Those have been long in coming. There were major aid commitments made. Some of them look rather unrealistic and are not likely to be realized. Others of them in the major capitals in London and Washington and elsewhere are building real pressure, including in Tokyo, on fulfillment of those obligations. And what's interesting is when you look at the preparations for the G8 that's upcoming this summer in St. Petersburg in Russia for the first time ever. The Russians were at first somewhat puzzled as to how to deal with this inheritance, this momentum of such strong focus on Africa, which was building pressures and expectations and continuity. And as the preparation process has unfolded in the last couple of months, the Africa agenda has come back in a very strong way, which is, I think, another piece of evidence that, in fact, this does matter in significant ways. I agree entirely with what Princeton said about the Live Aid concert as a phenomenon of treating Africa as a charity case and having no presence, and treating it as entirely a wealth transfer or a development transfer issue, grossly oversimplifies the debate. But I also think that some of the key figures in that, like Bono, are actually very sophisticated at a technical level around what all these issues mean. And I don't think you are entering this discussion with blinkers on or overly simplifying the debates. I think that the way in which they've been approached is increasingly sophisticated in many ways.
Does the public, though, see that? Because we talked a little bit earlier, as I was talking to you before the program started, about how there seems to be this image that is portrayed by the media and that is in the public mind of Africa as a charity case, a place where you either are worried about famine or people dying from starvation or from genocide or war. How do you get people to see it differently?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a responsibility of the leadership in the United States, the President, the Secretary of State, and others, to present a different view of how we see Africa and how important Africa is to the United States. There has to be more showcasing of what Africans are doing, the positive trends that take place. That isn't to diminish attention to the problems you mentioned, but there have been positive trends on democratization, on economic policy. There are a number of countries of Africa that are doing very well, that have overcome great difficulties. How do we get that into the media is difficult. There's a study on the way Africa is presented in the media that did an analysis of it, and it came up with the results that every 20 minutes somewhere in the media around the country, Africa is associated with death, starvation, or devastation. And that gets reinforced, and it's going to take quite an effort to change that.
Mr. Morrison, would you like to add anything?
Well, two things. One is there are habits within our own media that perpetuate these stereotypes, and there needs to be greater consciousness and effort to push back on that within the media establishment itself. Second point is that you have new engagement by American societal interest at a level that's unprecedented. And by that I mean the level of engagement by the American religious communities is at a level unlike anything we've seen that gives voice to them. And you have important new constituencies within the religious community, the evangelical community being the most important new arrival in that domain. You have powerful, well-positioned, very committed new foundations at work here. Not all new, but you have the Gates Foundation as a major player pressing on the public health sector. You have Rockefeller reengaging. You have a consortium of major foundations making a multi-year commitment to revitalize higher education in Africa in key universities. You have the expansion in an unprecedented level of engagement in terms of public health. Schools of public health, non-governmental groups, faith-based organizations, universities, medical schools, and the like, to a significant degree driven by the commitments made on HIV/AIDS. All of those things give voice and perspective and experience to a sector, to different sectors of American society that one hopes will begin to change that deep pessimism that you see as a kind of reflexive, fairly shallow reflexive pessimism that's out there.
So you've talked about NGOs' involvement in terms of aid and assistance to Africa. What about the foreign assistance that the country is giving now? What is behind it? What kind is it, and what is behind it? Why is it? What is driving it?
Well, part of it, of course, is a very important part of Americans' outlook on situations like Africa is humanitarian and concern. And the levels of assistance to Africa have grown over the last 10 years. They hit a low point in the late 90s, but now they've come back. But if you look at the composition, you'll find that about half of it is emergency aid in response to famine, in response to conflict, et cetera, all of which is perfectly right. But the levels of investment in long-term growth have remained flat for a long time. And second, we go in and out of fads. We're into agriculture for a while, and then we get out of agriculture, and then we don't invest enough in the new technologies. And if we're serious about this, we have to use that assistance more strategically on long-term commitments in fields like education, agriculture, science, and technology. And if, as the G8 said, aid to Africa will double over the next 5 years, that it's very important that it double in those areas and not only in emergency aid.
Thank you, Mr. Lyman. And did you want to add anything else on the country's assistance to Africa?
U.S. assistance.
Yes, the U.S. assistance to Africa.
Well, we're in a period of innovation around U.S. foreign assistance. We had the launch of the President's Emergency Plan on HIV/AIDS, which is 15 country focused globally, 12 in Africa. It's now amounting to transfers of over $3 billion a year. It's catalyzed other donors to come forward today so that the transfers on HIV are over $8 billion this year from a base of about $1 billion in the year 2000. So that's a major development. It's complex. It's in a very difficult implementation phase. But overall, it's a very commendable, very laudable kind of leadership. It's very much driven at the very top of our government as an initiative. Then you have the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which was launched in 2002.
And can you explain what that is and what it
does? This is a new logic of foreign aid that says we're going to have a very lean, almost foundation-based, non-bureaucratic approach in which you select out as candidates states that are reforming themselves and performing well on economic and democratic grounds. And you invite them to come forward and propose a compact in which a very, very substantial body of resources would be transferred over a multi-year period in order to bring about dramatic gains in economic growth. And that, we think, is, in, as we say in this Council on Foreign Relations report that's just been issued, we say is a very worthy concept and deserves to be carried forward. It got off to a faulty beginning. However, it's been given another shot at success and carrying forward. The last thing I'd say is that if you look back at the recent speech by Secretary Rice on January 18th on transformational diplomacy, arguing that there needs to be a reallocation of diplomatic strength towards Africa and towards Asia and towards places that have been depleted in recent years, and there needs to be a much more concentrated and coherent approach that interlinks our foreign aid. Those two things are very important. They're uncertain in their outcomes, but they're very important, and they help put a focus back on Africa and are very consistent themes with the arguments that we're making.
Getting back to this whole idea of seeing Africa, the continent, as a humanitarian case, the continent has vast resources. Right now, America gets about 15% of its oil imports from Africa. Why not more oil from Africa? Would that not help Africa to become more self-sufficient? Princeton Lyman?
Well, we are going to be getting more. African production is going up very rapidly. The big producers, Nigeria and Angola, will double production in this decade. And Africa will probably account for 20 or 25% of our imports in over the next decade. And that does raise a number of both opportunities and challenges, because oil has not always been a blessing for the countries that produce it. And I think we've learned from the Middle East and elsewhere that we have to be concerned when billions of dollars are going to be flowing into these areas, how well they're going to be used, and how we can work to make sure that they are well used in cooperation with those governments. It's also a very insecure part of Africa that is the main production area, the Gulf of Guinea. And what we have suggested in this report is that we really need to focus on our energy interests in Africa in cooperation with those producing countries, both to help secure those areas, to quell some of the piracy and some of the criminal activity that is now going on there, and to work to assure more transparency in how the resources are used.
Mr. Morrison.
Just to reinforce some of the points Princeton made, the Gulf of Guinea states, the energy-rich states, and the principal ones being Nigeria, Angola, Sao Tome, Equatorial Guinea, they're going through a period of major growth of discovery and production on oil. Over 60 billion barrels of proven reserves, another 2 to 3 million barrels of production coming on stream in just the next couple of years. They are going to be experiencing an avalanche of cash coursing through their systems. Dealing with the resource curse is going to be a really tough challenge for everyone. And it's on top of a situation in which we have some of the largest criminal syndicates operating in the world operating out of the Niger Delta in Nigeria. We're talking about at any one point anywhere from 70,000 to 300,000 barrels a day that are stolen and that are feeding illicit trafficking in weapons and money laundering and feeding the piracy in that area. So our argument is we need to get really serious about this region. It's going to be a really tough agenda in the coming years. In U.S. foreign policy, there needs to be a geopolitical shift towards a higher level of engagement and focus. The maritime environment is a largely ungoverned environment today. Most of these new discoveries are offshore. There's a large liquid natural gas sector that's going to emerge in the next 5 years that will be of global import. All of those things argue for a much higher level of engagement.
In that answer, you talked about something that is an often used criticism of why things do not work or may not happen as people would like to see them happen on the African continent. You talked about crime and sort of alluded to corruption. Can you address that? Is the corruption there as bad as it is often thought to be or said to be? Is it standing in the way of progress? How do you view corruption in on the continent?
Well, corruption is a serious problem in a lot of parts of the world, and it has been a problem in Africa as well, where you have a concentration of resources flowing through some central locations, and they become sources of political patronage and then corruption. There are efforts in several African countries to address this. The Nigerians have done, this Nigerian government has done a lot to clean up the procurement system and make its budget more transparent and do a number of other steps. You have in Zambia a serious investigation of past corruption of the past president and his entire cabinet. And these corruption investigations lead back to Europe and in some cases to the United States because the briberies come from companies outside of Africa. So it's a common problem. Now in the G8 Africa dialogue, corruption is a major concern, and there are a number of steps being taken. It's one that we have to work on together with those African governments and those elements in civil society in Africa who are determined to reduce this problem.
Is it getting better, worse? Which do you think, Mr. Morrison?
I think we've seen mixed results, but we've seen in the last couple of years some pretty surprising efforts, some pretty surprising initiatives to corral corruption and bring greater accountability and transparency. The Minister of Finance in Nigeria, who gave up a career and a very long and distinguished career at the World Bank to go back and lead the reform effort in Nigeria, she's shown some significant results. They're fragile, and the long-term sustainability is an open question. But these are serious efforts, and they strike at the very core of what needs to happen. If Nigeria can turn the corner, this will have profound demonstration effects. We see the emergence of the Chad-Cameroon pipeline model, which is now under severe stress because of the insecurity within Chad itself and the efforts by the government to break out of that agreement. But this was a compact that brought together non-governmental interests within Chad, international advocacy groups, the World Bank, the major super majors that were there as partners, with dedicated resources towards education and health, towards rainy day fund for future generations, and with oversight committees. And it was a complex model. It's under stress, but nonetheless it began to show that you could be innovative in trying to bring accountability and transparency to growing oil sectors in Africa.
What are the other promising avenues for economic development other than oil?
Well, one of the things, if we're serious, and that's really the question, is to address head-on the trade issue, because the World Trade Organization structure is heavily biased against agricultural production in developing countries. We in the Europeans spend $350 billion a year on agricultural subsidies, and the World Bank sees most of these as trade distorting to the disadvantage of developing countries. We have heavy tariffs on products coming from those countries. If we really want to see African countries grow, there has to be reform of the trading system to open up those opportunities. Not all the countries will be able to take advantage of them, but it will be a very important step to giving an opportunity. Two-thirds of Africans live in rural areas. They live in the agricultural sector, and we have to be serious about that. It's a tough domestic issue for the United States and for the Europeans, but again, it's a question of how serious we are. There are other opportunities. The cell phone industry is probably expanding more rapidly in Africa than anywhere else. American companies haven't been in on this, but the South Africans have to do fairly well, and some European companies. And there are export areas in new areas of textiles, flowers, Uganda, Kenya, other countries now becoming major exporters of flowers to Europe and to some extent to the United States. So there are opportunities out there that are developing, but we've got to open up the trade areas.
Is that happening? Who's working on that? Making changes in the trade policy, and how successful are those efforts, Mr. Morrison, or Mr. Lyman, whichever?
Most of the debate is really centered in the Doha round, and which is the, you know, the most recent global negotiations around terms of trade in trying to open markets and open access, and that process is prone to delays and complexities and breakdown, and we've seen that. And it requires constant sort of rejuvenation. It's one that runs up against these significant barriers that Princeton's talked about in terms of the domestic stakes in Europe and in the United States at opening. And the what's promising, perhaps, or new and different in this respect is that the African country leadership on the trade issues are much more united today than they have been before. They're much more sophisticated in their ability to negotiate as a block, to make the, to hold other things against compromise by the West towards access of their production into the rich markets in the North. And that is new and different, and it's promising, because it means that they're negotiating more effectively. They're pushing hard. They're making us see this as something that we have to have a grander strategy for. The other factor that we've not talked about is the entry of China into the equation. China and many of the other major Asian powers, India, South Korea, Malaysia, have entered Africa in a very profound and dramatic, multifaceted way. We try to bring a lot of attention to this in the report that we've just issued as to the mixed outcomes, what we don't know in terms of the uncertainties and the like. But China has entered in terms of selling itself as an advocate and as a political ally and as a basis of solidarity. What that means in terms of trade access, the question you've pointed to, very unclear. What that means in terms of human rights or democratic accountability implications or business practices, also very unclear. But there's a new level of competition within Africa among major powers. Russia's completely out of the picture, but you have a very intensifying competitive field, and it has impacts in terms of influence on a range of issues, including these trade issues.
What does all of that point to or say for entrepreneurs in this country who may want to do business with Africa, especially African Americans who might see this as a potential market for their products, services, whatever their companies might be? Mr. Lyman?
One of the promising things in Africa is that there's a growing generation of entrepreneurs in Africa who are resourceful and who are dedicated to developing the private sector, which has not been well developed in the past. And I think there are opportunities there, but it's a hard market to work in. And for small businesses, particularly in the United States, the investment of that much time and energy is hard to do. But if you find the right partners or work through venture capital funds, and there are now a number of them focused on Africa, the opportunities are there in the information technology, which is expanding very rapidly, and some of the other areas I mentioned. And some of these funds are getting very good returns in Africa.
Would you like to add anything to that, Mr. Morrison?
We've seen the maturation here in the United States of organizations that promote trade and investment, the Corporate Council on Africa being the most notable. We've seen more aggressive action by the U.S. government through the Commerce Department at putting together in Southern Africa a regional trade promotion, investment promotion office. There's only a few of those around the world. This is a notable step, a laudable step. U.S. two-way trade with Africa remains less than 1% of total world trade, so we need to keep that in perspective. And it's concentrated still in the energy sector. So we're talking at fairly modest levels that we're trying to build out. On textiles, on agricultural processing, there's considerable opportunity, but let's be honest, too. We're facing intensifying competition coming out of Asia that is directly running up against, certainly on the textile piece. You know, there was liberalization through the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act in 2000 of the terms, expanded access for entry into American markets. Much of that is under stress right now because of the lapse of the multi-fiber agreement, but also because of competition.
Can you do in Africa what has been done on the Asian continent in terms of the growth of those economies in China and India?
I think you have to really differentiate. We're talking about in sub-Saharan Africa 48 different countries, and there's quite a range of difference between them. Some have very sophisticated economies like South Africa. Some have greater access to transportation links and ports and export possibilities, and some are landlocked without resources and very poor. And I think if the trade opportunities open up and some of these other reforms of foreign assistance are done, that you'll see a number of countries in Africa over the next decade who will move out and become much more a part of the world economy and with benefits that go back through the society. And then there'll be other countries that are going to be poor for a very long time. And the international community has to decide in terms of education and health to whether to subsidize continually those countries because they can't carry those programs by themselves. So it's going to be quite a differentiation across the continent.
You mentioned earlier, Mr. Morrison, the increase in aid to Africa for fighting the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Many people believe that no matter what you do with the economy, because this epidemic is growing so fast and wiping out so many people, that, you know, you're just not going to be able to get a handle on making things better unless you bring this under control. How well are we doing on bringing it under control?
So far, I mean, there's been a major mobilization the last 4 or 5 years. Very intensifying effort to bring care, prevention, and treatment programs into southern and eastern Africa, where the epidemic is concentrated. We are at this moment of implementation, and you see some promising data coming forward in terms of changing behavior out of high-risk behavior and the lowering of prevalence rates. There was some data just released a couple of days ago that suggested that between 1998 and 2003 that prevalence among adults, HIV prevalence in Zimbabwe had dropped by 5 percentage points, and that was directly attributable to expanded prevention efforts and changing norms and sexual habits by adult populations. But And we're seeing some data that's similar to that in places like Kenya and Uganda and Tanzania, Zambia, Botswana. There are places where programs are reaching scale, where the data is improving, where knowledge and consciousness is improving. And so we have to stick with that. The big picture remains daunting. The epidemic in the big picture continues to grow. The broader prevention efforts have not registered on a scale that would give you hope that this is going to be reversed anytime soon. There needs to be a new look at the priority attached to prevention, and the fact that as we move forward on prevention, on a disease which is fundamentally about sex, that we run into increased tensions in our own culture between those who favor a purely public health approach that favors condoms and those that are coming from a religious or moral values perspective that are favoring abstinence and fidelity. And we've had, those are not necessarily oppositional or exclusive, but we do see increased tensions publicly in the clash between these approaches, which also begs the question of how are we going to make sure that we don't erode the enthusiasm and the bipartisan consensus around carrying this forward. Prevention is a very tough thing. It's a tough thing to sustain. It's a tough thing to prove. And yet it's central to bringing this epidemic under control.
So, Mr. Lyman, is this tension around philosophies about prevention then not helping the problem? Is it then keeping us from moving forward with help making a dent in the epidemic?
It's a very important question, because the thrust of increased activity on HIV/AIDS that Steve Morrison mentioned earlier, the increase in the U.S. commitment, it was a very bipartisan effort coming from the Congress as well as from the President. And it brought in a lot of constituencies from the religious community, from others, et cetera. But now we're seeing this divisive debate carrying, if you will, our own cultural wars into this of abstinence versus condoms, et cetera, which threatens to divide that constituency around these programs and impact on the ability in the field to carry out programs that are most appropriate in each country. And that's a serious problem that, if we don't arrest that, could unravel what has been a very strong constituency on behalf of this pandemic.
So once again, who's addressing this and trying to find the middle ground that is going to be the best for the continent? Mr. Morrison.
The experience in terms of the U.S. approach, the experience in the last couple of years has been the centrality of White House leadership on these issues. Randall Tobias was appointed by the President as the Global AIDS Coordinator with a very strong mandate and ability to move forward. And I think that will remain very much incumbent on the current and future White House to sort of carry these initiatives forward and to change the discourse and to keep people focused on the common goals and the approaches that need to be taken. I want to just bring back into the discussion the whole question around treatment, around antiretroviral treatment, because that is also tied to this. The administration's made a commitment to put 2 million people in a 5-year span onto antiretroviral treatment, most of them in Africa. This is unprecedented in the sense that, as a foreign policy priority, as a priority of the White House, putting people in poor settings, scattered across many different countries, 2 million of them, on a complex therapy that requires very careful monitoring, requires a complex medication that is delivered in a reliable way, and it's for a disease for which there's no cure and no vaccine and none in sight at the moment. And it's a life-extending therapy, so you can't withdraw this. And this is a major priority, and it's tough. It's going to be prone to diversion and fraud and breakdown. It's expensive. It's going to be more expensive than we realize. And it's unprecedented in terms of a foreign policy commitment.
Is that commitment likely to survive throughout a new administration?
I think it's going to be very hard to walk this back. It's going to be most important to show that this is working and succeeding. Thus far, the administration has been very successful at preserving the enthusiasm around this program. The budget request that just came forward has a total of $4 billion requested for HIV/AIDS, which is a symbol, I think, of the enthusiasm that still resides within Congress around pushing on this. They've been able to contribute to bringing somewhere in the order of over 450,000 people on treatment in the first two-year period. That's significant, and that is driving a certain momentum. Bringing treatment is very important in terms of changing behavior and bringing effective prevention as well, because treatment brings hope. Treatment tells people that they are not doomed, and it gives people motivation to come forward, know their status, and protect themselves and protect others that are in their lives.
Let's talk, Mr. Lyman, about another area where people are dying, and that is in the Sudan, in Darfur. Many Americans have criticized the administration and said, you're going after Saddam Hussein for killing his own people. Why aren't you going after the leaders in Darfur for killing their own people? What is happening there?
Well, in Darfur, as you say, Barbara, it's a very serious humanitarian crisis arising from a rebellion in that part of Sudan, which the government responded to by arming and encouraging local militias who drove 2 million people out of their homes and committed some horrific acts, and the violence continues. The U.S. is the only country that has declared this a genocide. Other countries have waffled back and forth on whether it is, but the UN has said at least there are crimes against humanity and acts of genocide there. It is the Africans that have taken the lead in trying to provide security. They have pledged to bring 7,000 peacekeepers into Darfur. They're almost up to that level, but they've really reached the limits of their ability, and they're not going to be able to cover this situation. It's complicated because here is a country that when the government of Sudan, when the United States first said this is a genocide, said, and you could see this throughout the press in the Middle East, this isn't genocide. That isn't what's driving the United States. They're just after another Arab oil-producing country. So watch out. And that's had an inhibiting effect on our ability in this area. The other has been that in the Security Council, where it's important to bring pressure on the Khartoum government, serious pressure, sanctions, etc., the Chinese, along with the Russians, have prevented the Security Council from doing it because the Chinese own 40% of the oil industry in Sudan and get 7% of their oil imports from there, and they have protected that regime in that regard. I think we're at a very critical point now, and it's now generally recognized, and it's what we had proposed in this report, that Africa can't do this alone, that the international community must supplement that force with a larger and more active force into the area to protect the people who are still vulnerable. But who's going to do it and how it's going to be done, whether it's going to be done under the general UN auspices or whether you can get others to come in earlier while the UN organizes itself, those are issues that are very difficult to deal with. Kofi Annan has raised it with the president. It raised the question of what role the U.S. is going to play. We haven't put troops into UN peacekeeping since Somalia in 1993. So there are some tough issues out there, and there are some questions about whether you can change the Chinese attitude or go outside the UN to put much more pressure on the Khartoum government.
Is the war in Iraq having an effect on our decision to do something or not do something in Sudan, Mr. Morrison?
It's certainly constraining us in our ability to think seriously about putting troops into almost any other setting. First of all, and, you know, walk back to the Liberia crisis in the summer of 2003, which came to a head in the within the administration, where in the summer of 2003 there were something like 7 principal-level, cabinet-level meetings on Liberia and the whole question of whether to deploy troops. That coincided with a dramatic downturn in the prospects on the ground militarily in Iraq, and that worsening situation in Iraq had a direct impact on the willingness of the administration to talk seriously about putting significant U.S. troops in as the vanguard force in Liberia. You had, for the first time in over 10 years, you had the Pentagon or the European command arguing, yes, we can do this, we should do this, and the risks are manageable, and we should. But they walked back on that. We see a continued problem of this kind when we're talking about Darfur. There is less latitude to move, and there's less stomach to move. We also see the blowback in terms of our diplomatic standing and leverage in the Arab world in getting folks to acknowledge the realities in Darfur. There's this filter, there's this screen, this distorting screen of a blowback from Iraq that makes it very hard to get past the skepticism and suspicion around U.S. motivations, to get a focus on the realities on the ground of what is going on. And we struggle with that.
So it's not likely to change anytime soon. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I would say that if it's good that the U.N. is finally coming to a recognition that it has to go beyond just relying on the Africa Union. And if the U.N. does act and if they can mobilize contributions of troops, it will make a difference. But it has to be done rapidly, not spun out over 6 or 8 months. But I think there is growing consensus between the Africa Union, between the U.N., between the other countries, that just relying on the African Peace Force is not going to do it.
This sort of leads into, what is Africa's strategic position? Does it have one? Is it changing as it relates to the U.S. and the war on terrorism?
Well, the terrorism is a real issue in Africa. We know that American embassies were blown up by al-Qaeda in 1998, 3 years ahead of 9/11. We know there are terrorist cells down the east coast of Africa. There's a major U.S. effort, an allied effort, to try and intervene and to stop the flow of weapons and people down the coast, and it's not going to be an easy thing to do. We know that there are targeted efforts in West Africa to take advantage of either religious tensions or economic or other things. And several of the African countries are quite seized with the issue. But our response, in large part so far, has come from our military commands. And the response has been too heavily on the military side. And I think we've got to broaden that out with more political oversight and a broader view, and work with those countries in Africa that are taking this issue quite seriously.
Would you like to add anything to that, Mr. Morrison?
What we are arguing is that you do have known cells and networks in the Horn of Africa. You also have very key vulnerabilities in northern Nigeria, where our presence on the ground, our knowledge, is fairly thin. It's hard to speak with much confidence about exactly what is going on, and that this needs to be corrected in terms of our approaches. We also point to certain specific urban environments in South Africa where this remains a concern. The approach that we have taken thus far, as Princeton says, is overwhelmingly focused upon the military response. We've learned some lessons around that. We've learned that the absence of a strong diplomatic voice and oversight can cost us in terms of our ability to engage and build the kind of partnerships that we need. In the case of Mauritania, we were left looking fairly embarrassed when you had the overthrow of a government that was, its legitimacy had sunk, partly because it had used the counterterrorism excuse to repress its own opposition, in alliance, apparent alliance with the United States. Our credibility can be put at risk in those settings if we're not really, really careful in how we proceed.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program, and tonight we're talking about United States policy toward Africa. I'm Barbara Rogers, and I'm here with Princeton Lyman of the Council on Foreign Relations, Dr. Tete Kofi of the University of San Francisco, and J. Stephen Morrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Now let's go to our audience questions. If you would please come to the microphone to ask your question. Yes, go right on.
What is the role of microlending and microenterprise in addressing poverty and economic development in Africa? And are there any hopeful developments on that front?
And are you directing it to any particular panelists?
Whoever cares to answer.
Well, let me say some things about it, and others might comment on it. Microlending is a very important tool for reaching people very near the bottom of the economic scale and giving them opportunities for educating their children, getting a handle on it. It's very important for women who often don't have access to those resources and need it. But not a lot of those entrepreneurs move up the scale to become middle level. So I think we have to be careful that we don't think that that's the answer to the private sector development side of Africa. It's an important area. It has a lot to do with helping people who need it the most, but it doesn't produce that broad scale economic growth that's needed throughout the private sector.
Would you like to add anything to that, either Mr. Morrison or Professor Kofi?
We have an economist here.
Yeah,
the questions. Okay. No, it's okay.
All right, next question.
Yeah, I just have a couple of quick questions. First, to Mr. Lyman, you mentioned that, you know, our spotty efforts in funding agricultural development in Africa, and it seems to me that that seems a pretty obvious solution to a lot of the, you know, a lot of the hunger and starvation issues is to teach people how, you know, teach them how to farm efficiently and effectively. And just a real quick second question to Mr. Morrison is, well, actually to Mr. Lyman, why isn't that a main focus of our aid? And to Mr. Morrison, you mentioned the compacts that the countries are doing with pipelines and other things. Do you see any kind of potential for the democratic countries in Africa to unite, similar to Europe, in the EU, and to have really a second USA in the world with the United States of Africa? Thank you.
Mr. Lyman, you can go first.
Yes. You know, we have a tendency in the foreign aid program and to go in and out of areas that are fashionable. We invested heavily in agricultural development in the 70s and 80s. In the 1990s, both the United States and the World Bank reduced our investments in agricultural development in Africa by 90%. It just wasn't fashionable. Now we are saying, gee, we need to do more of that. And it's not, new technologies are needed. Africa is an exceptionally drought-prone continent. And there are problems in productivity that require new kinds of technology. So it takes research, and it takes sustained effort. And then we have to come back into a field that, unfortunately, we moved out of. You would think it was obvious, but Congress comes in and says we'd like a little bit here and a little bit there, and things become less fashionable. And I think it's important that we identify key sectors and make the long-term commitments that will make a difference, and I think agriculture is clearly one of them. Education is another, and you can pick three or four.
Dr. Kofi, did you want to comment on that before we go to Mr. Morrison for the next question?
Yeah. You spoke about United States of Africa, right? About 100 years ago, there was a West Indian historian who visited Liberia, traveled a lot in Africa, and he wanted to talk to Queen Victoria. And he wanted Queen Victoria to colonize the whole of West Africa so that when they get independence, they will have a big area to work with, okay? And that didn't work out. So the British colonized the southern parts near the coast. And so what happened was there was a vacuum in the northern parts, and the French moved in. So you have the type of colonization which is longitudinal. The desert area is taken by the French, and the forest area is taken by the British. So that has been a big problem and is going to be a problem, and I wish Queen Victoria and the British had listened to to Blyden, okay? And so we have a problem whereby food production in the Sahel region is a problem and so on. Nkrumah tried to organize OAU, or the whole of Africa, into states and so on. And I know what happened, but we don't want to get into that. So the continent has a serious problem, and maybe through education, people will listen to what should be done, and they will start doing it. And I think the EU is starting to do something. It may be too late, but it will be done in the future.
Mr. Morrison?
I don't think you're going to see anything approaching, an amalgamation like the United States of Africa. But what you do see, because it's simply because of the enduring power of sovereignty on the continent, but what you do see happening is the creation of the African Union in the last few years, which was the reform of the prior organization, the Organization of African Unity, and a new set of norms around peer review, around democratic adherence to democratic process, and significant leadership coming from South Africa and Nigeria and Senegal. It's early days. It's early days to see how this is brought into practice. The continued tyranny in Zimbabwe has been a very nettlesome issue that's caused a lot of consternation around how serious are these countries in terms of democratic norms and self-criticism and the like. The U.S. has a big role to play in supporting this. We argue in our report, and I think we're likely to see, an elevation of diplomatic relations with the African Union and the expansion of programs of support. You have a number of different sub-regional groups, the ECA, the East African Community, that is integrating and promoting greater economic trade. You have Southern African Development Community, and you have the West African ECOWAS communities. These are important institutions as well.
Thank you. Next question.
Dr. Morrison almost preempted my question with those comments on the African Union and governance, but perhaps I can ask the other panelists as well as you to elaborate on trends in governance quality within African countries, and in particular, Ambassador Lyman, whether South Africa is doing now better or worse with respect to governance than you anticipated when you were ambassador at the transition.
Well, I think what you do see is clearly, as uneven as it may be, a democratic trend in Africa that is very different from 15 or 20 years ago, where most African governments are elected, where this new organization, the Africa Union, says we will not cede a government that comes to power by non-constitutional means. You have several African governments that have gone through successful electoral changes of administration, Senegal, Ghana, et cetera. But the institutions underneath, the judiciary, the strength of parties, the strength of parliament, still very, very weak. And so this is a fragile but important trend. There is an emphasis in the norms being proposed by the Africa Union called the New Partnership for African Development that emphasizes better governance. It also, in regard to the previous question, emphasizes more free trade among subregions of Africa, bringing them closer together in common markets, if not into a single political entity. So I think those trends are positive but still fragile and need a lot of encouragement. On South Africa, I think that what is encouraging about it is some of those democratic institutions remain very strong. And just the key examples to me are the government has lost several very important cases before the highest court and have bowed to the decisions of the court. And although the parliament is dominated heavily by one party, the African National Congress, it's not a rollover parliament. There is dynamism there, and the press is free. So I think in terms of democratic institutions, South Africa has done very well. It's got lots of problems in terms of unemployment, et cetera, but on the whole in governance, I think they've done well.
Yes, Professor Kofi.
I just want to make a couple of comments on this question. Historically, there have been attempts to create economic union in Africa. I remember that Nkrumah in the early 60s, late 50s, tried to spearhead economic union in Africa by forming what came to be known as the Casablanca Group. This is Ghana, Guinea, and the Northern Arab countries. And then the Monrovia Group started another efforts at putting some countries together to form a union. And then it became politicized. The Casablanca Group were leftists, and the Monrovia Group spearhead by Mr. Talbot and the president of Monrovia of Liberia. So there have been attempts at these, and it became a political problem and didn't work out. If you take the purely economic approach, there have been several attempts at this economic approach, all right, starting with British decolonization of East Africa. They already had a union type, which had to do with the economic union, telegraphs, and so on. But that disintegrated because Kenya was benefiting from the union too much than Tanzania and Uganda. So it broke up, okay. Maybe it's easier when there is economic reason for union, and then it will work out. But unionization is a big problem. And in Africa, with the colonial influence and the continued influence of these colonial countries, I mean, the imperial powers, it's been very difficult to form an economic union. But we'll hope so. Now, in the case of South Africa has been spearheading the economic union through what they call NEPAD, New Economic Policy for Africa, and so on. I don't know if it will work because the South African approach, in my mind, is not seriously fundamental with regard to employment and so on. So we don't know what they are doing. And some of us are trying to lay the foundations for a proper union through agricultural innovations. I just finished a paper on the role of the chiefs. I'm arguing that the chiefs should be brought back into the policy making so that they can start integrating agricultural programs and so on traditional institutional basis and so on. But these are some suggestions that we have in place of NEPAD.
Mr. Morrison, did you want to add anything?
No, I'm fine.
Okay, next question.
My question is, to what extent are individual African leaders participating in the resolution of some of these problems?
Any particular panelists?
No.
Maybe all of you can take a stab at it. Mr. Morrison, you want to start?
Well, you've seen a strong leadership exercised by individual African leaders in trying to resolve a number of conflicts. On the Darfur side, President Obasanjo has taken the lead on the Abuja negotiations that are attempting to get a negotiated settlement to the Darfur crisis, and has pushed hard on that. The South African government, beginning with then President Mandela, took the lead on Burundi and has stuck with that and has shown some steady progress in Burundi in arresting what was seen as a threat of escalating inter-ethnic violence there and brought that back. The Congo crisis in the early part of this decade was adrift. The South African government joined together with Kofi Annan in trying to put a renewed push on that, which has resulted in a couple of successive new compacts. We're heading towards elections, transitional elections this year in Congo. That would not have happened if you had not had the kind of leadership coming from within Africa. Going back to the era, the Algiers Accord between Ethiopia and Eritrea of the end of 2000, which is now getting revisited, and we can talk more about that. But that accord, which ended the hottest conventional war in the world, at that time, which had raged between 98 and 2000, it was really contingent on very serious engagement by Algeria in concert with the UN and with the United States in the form of Tony Lake.
Professor Kofi, you want to add anything?
Yeah. The comment I make is that it is difficult to solve African problems. You have to identify the country and understand whatever problems it is having. In the case of Zimbabwe, as you mentioned, Mugabe is a very serious man, the way I see it. He may not be liked in the West, but I have a great deal of respect for Mugabe. He moved to Ghana, was teaching in a high school, and he was very serious. He studied the situation in Zimbabwe, joined the guerrilla war in Zimbabwe, fought his way out until they got independence. And if we understand the historical situation, Ian Smith and the British government were against granting independence at that time, and they were one of the last countries to get independence. So in a way, I have respect for him. Now, what he's doing now, I think, is trying to reorganize the society, solve the unemployment problem, and so on and so forth. He may run against other people who have other ideas, but I think he is trying to restructure the country and embark on economic program. We may not like it because he's leftist, but he's done his homework. He studied very hard, as I said, when he was in Ghana. He laid the program, and we may not like his program, but maybe we should give him the chance and see what he can do.
All right. Mm-hmm. We have time for one last quick question.
Thank you. I continue to be struck by the absence of any discussion sort of in the media or among governments about the impact of malaria as a health crisis of equal or possibly greater proportion than HIV. Other than the work that the Gates Foundation is doing, I'm curious what the G8 is doing with regards to this crisis. Thank you.
Well,
Mr. Lyman.
The Global Fund that was created largely to combat HIV/AIDS is, in fact, a global fund for HIV/AIDS, TB, and malaria. The U.S. has just announced a $1.2 billion initiative on malaria. Malaria is now beginning to get serious attention, whereas it wasn't before as much as it should, partly because there are new technologies available. Better treatment. We have gotten past the debate on spraying in houses so that now we can move forward on that. And there is renewed input from the Gates Foundation. So I think now we're going to get more serious attention on malaria, which is, of course, quite needed. I have to say, I do disagree with the good professor on Robert Mugabe. I think he has devastated the economy of Zimbabwe. He may have been a great leader when he brought independence, but I'm afraid I don't share your admiration for what he's doing today.
Well, that will have to be our last word because we are out of time. Thank you, audience, for all of your wonderful questions. And let's give a big hand to the panelists for their thoughts here tonight. Now, this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. 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 Club is adjourned.